I'm Shepard Smith on CNBC, and this is the news.
Last night, the FBI and Michigan State Police arrested six individuals.
A shocking, sinister plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan, thwarted by the FBI. Tonight, how a militia group planned to violently overthrow the state government.
Lives are at stake.
The recovery hits a wall. People are sick. Millions unemployed. Stimulus stalled. Even if airlines get aid, what about the rest of America? Fears of the fall surge growing.
That's not the optimal position to be in as you enter into the fall and winter.
Are we prepared? One frontline worker's dire warning, we're not ready for what's coming. The Titans record another positive COVID test. Now another game at risk of being postponed. Can the NFL contain the virus and save our football season? A violent group of militant men planned to kidnap the governor of Michigan, overthrow that state's government, and incite a civil war. That is the official word from the FBI and Michigan's attorney general. They never got the chance. SWAT teams and federal agents launched raids, arresting what they call a suspected domestic terror cell before they could carry out any attack. Investigators say the men planned to abduct the Democratic governor, Gretchen Whitmer, snatch her from her vacation home, take her to some hideout in Wisconsin, and put her on trial for treason. Or, to save time, just shoot her when she answered the door. According to the Federals, the militiamen went on a recon mission, taking photos and videos of the governor's summer home, and discussed storming the Michigan State Capitol, taking hostages there, and attacking police with Molotov cocktails. For some context here, remember the protests of the COVID lockdown back in April when armed militia members stormed Michigan State Capitol building with high-powered rifles? Well, at least one of the suspects in this new plot was there at the protest, according to one of his friends. And listen to what that friend told a local news station in Grand Rapids.
I knew he belonged to the militia, but I didn't know it was this deep. He has changed in the last 8 months with the COVID wearing a mask. He believes his constitution rights were taken away from him. He's afraid that if the Democrats become in, he kept saying they're going to take our Second Amendment rights away.
Governor Whitmer accused President Trump of fomenting anger during the pandemic.
Just last week, the President of the United States stood before the American people and refused to condemn white supremacists and hate groups like these two Michigan militia groups. Stand back and stand by, he told them. Stand back and stand by. Hate groups heard the president's words not as a rebuke, but as a rallying cry.
Michigan's attorney general says today's crackdown on extremists may be what she calls the tip of the iceberg. NBC News justice correspondent Pete Williams with us now. Pete?
Well, a couple of points about this. Number one, there was no real danger to the governor, I think it's important to point out, because from the very beginning, the FBI had these six men under very close surveillance. There were FBI undercover operatives who were posing as like-minded individuals who met with them, who recorded phone calls with them, who videotaped meetings with them. So there was, you know, the government certainly alleges that these people had some pretty nasty thoughts in mind here. But at any point, the government could have shut it down and I think let it play out for a while to see who else was involved. So I think that's a very important thing to bear in mind here.
Pete, from what I read, it sounded like some of those who were inside this group saw some of the others and went, these guys act like they're serious.
Well, I think that's part of it. But what really got them onto it from the beginning was a concern by law enforcement that militia groups, anti-government people in Michigan were plotting to attack law enforcement. And they began to pick up on this, not through any terribly sophisticated undercover means, but just because of what these people were saying on social media. And so the FBI says they started to pay attention to these six early in the year, and then began to introduce the undercovers in who began to meet with them, And they were really following these guys closely from really June on until they were arrested last night.
Pete Williams from NBC, thank you. The United States continues to have a major COVID problem, and the numbers from the past week paint a grim picture. Daily cases up more than 8%, 41 states reporting an increase in cases, 23 states seeing hospitalization spike. Are hospitals stocked up and ready? Here's CNBC's Frank Holland.
The first surge of COVID-19 this spring.
We were never prepared for a disease crisis on this level.
Simply overwhelmed hospitals in the New York area.
At one point, almost every patient in our medical surgical units, our intensive care units, had coronavirus.
Today, healthcare workers have more training and more experience, but nationally.
We need N95s.
Dr. Esther Chu, an ER doctor and hospital researcher, says they do not have enough personal protective equipment for what appears to be a second surge of COVID-19.
Going into the fall, may see these stark images of hospital workers going in with makeshift masks and gowns.
The U.S. has a shortage of PPE, according to the FDA. In response, the federal government ordering more than 4.5 billion pairs of medical gloves, more than 5 million face shields, and 260 million face masks to be delivered by November. The largest nurses union in the U.S. says hospitals are not meeting their legal and moral obligations to provide adequate PPE.
The global supply chain, unfortunately, for a lot of these supplies is still short. So N95 masks still are on back order, certainly gowns and ventilators.
Dr. Sharif El-Nahal is the CEO of University Hospital near New York City, one of the hardest hit by COVID-19 cases.
We have to start being concerned if we reach a positivity rate of 5%.
He says if cases spike nationally, like they did in New York this spring, it would cause a near unthinkable crisis.
If this gets bad enough, we won't have the ability to treat everybody who walks into our door.
And the coming flu season could create even more shortages of PPE. The symptoms of COVID-19 and the flu, they're very similar. And frontline healthcare workers will have to use the same level of protection for both until a diagnosis, stretching those limited supplies even thinner. Shep?
Frank, the crisis right now growing in some spots. New York State seeing the most cases since May the 30th. Today, lockdowns start in some 9 New York City neighborhoods. In Idaho, the second highest positivity rate in all the nation, just more than 23%, that from Johns Hopkins. But tonight we're in Wisconsin yet again because that is looking like a sort of American ground zero. The situation dire and debilitating, bordering on a disaster in a small town in northeastern Wisconsin. That's what a doctor told me there today about the town of Shawna, population 9,000 outside Green Bay. Here, masks and precautions are generally unpopular. This video from a county fair just last month. Like the scientists tell us, no masks, no COVID spread. They have 8 hospitals in one system in that area, and every single one of them, says the doctor, is full. Just yesterday, the doctor told me an emergency appendectomy couldn't happen in town because there was no place to do it. Every bed full. Many medical workers are quarantined and sick, so they're hiring traveling nurses. There's a field hospital for overflow, but it is far, far away, 120 miles. Dr. Paul Casey's the doctor I mentioned. He's live at Bellin Hospital in Green Bay. Doctor, how serious is this?
So, Shepard, thank you for having me. We are on the verge of a crisis in Green Bay and our surrounding counties. Over the course of the last week, every single hospital system has been either near capacity, at capacity, or above capacity. This changes on a day-to-day basis. Fortunately, today we're having a good day at my hospital, Bellin. We actually have some beds today, but earlier in the week we had to elevate our contingency crisis level to red, which is the highest level. That changed. We're good today, but we could be back in crisis mode tomorrow.
You were telling me that hospitalizations are a lagging indicator. Usually about 6% of all patients end up in the hospital. And you're looking at the trend there. What do you see?
We see a frighteningly rising trend of COVID positivity rate above 20% in our community. So if you do the math,
20%.
Right, 20% in our community. Ooh. So if you take the math and plot it out over the next several weeks, that's going to be a lot of admissions. And you have to remember that these admissions come on top of everybody else we have to take care of with heart attacks, trauma, other illnesses. And under normal circumstances, all of our hospitals are very busy. Unlike in the spring, when we closed down normal operations, we canceled elective surgery, we're now back at full operations and trying to do everything we can to care for every patient who needs to come to the hospital. But if the rise continues and isn't abated, we're going to have to cancel elective surgeries again. We've not done that yet, but it's close.
Part of the reason we all have to be so safe, the scientists tell us, is to keep medical workers safe. How many people are we talking about in your system, medical workers who are quarantined or out with COVID?
In our system, it fluctuates between 150 and 200 people out on a given day. Wow. So that's a huge amount of healthcare workers who aren't available to take care of our patients. So even if we have enough beds, if we don't have enough nurses and respiratory therapists, we can't take care of patients.
Why is your community particularly and surrounding areas, why is it so much worse than many areas that we see across the country?
There are two reasons, I believe. Number one is we all have COVID fatigue. We're all tired of this virus. We want to go out and resume normalcy, go out to dinner with our friends, go to weddings, go to funerals, go to bars, go to county fairs. But this virus has been around. It didn't go away. We suppressed it based on our prior public health measures. But as soon as everything opened back up, it started to circulate in the community. So what we're currently seeing is that the vast majority of transmissions come from small gatherings. We track where we believe a patient becomes infected with COVID-19 when they're admitted. And the overwhelming trend we're seeing right now is people who go to a small family get-together, 6, 10, 15 people. One person is asymptomatic but positive, and a bunch of other people get it who then go out and spread it. The second reason is that, unfortunately, in some of our rural areas, there's a stark rebellion against wearing a mask. Some people believe this is a constitutional right violation, and they simply refuse to do it. They say, I'm not going to live in fear. I'm not going to wear a mask. Public health be damned. Let this virus circulate so we all get herd immunity. That's the second reason this virus is spreading with a vengeance.
Dr. Paul Casey, all the best to you and yours. We'll keep in touch. Thank you.
Thank you.
Remember how bad COVID was in Italy back in the spring? Well, today it's surging again. Italian doctors reporting the highest number of cases since the full lockdown there back in April. So lockdown across the country now. And masks are mandatory even outside. You get caught without one, that's a fine of $1,000. Since the pandemic began, Italy has had it rough. More than 36,000 people killed. Second highest number in all of Europe, right behind the United Kingdom. Live to Rome now, NBC's Claudia Lavagna is on the phone as the satellite is giving us some fits tonight. Claudio, how are Italians taking this mandate?
Well, Shepard, I'm tempted to answer the Italians are reacting surprisingly well, but if there's one thing that we learned from this pandemic is how respectful Italians can be of the rules sometimes, at least when it comes to coronavirus. Now, back in March, if somebody told me that overnight all Italians across the nation will just lock themselves in their homes just because the government told them so, well, I wouldn't have believed it, but that's exactly what they did. And this time around, they haven't even waited for the government to enforce this new rule of the...
Well, first the satellite and now the phone. Claudia Lavagna reporting from Rome. The bottom line is Italy has it rough. The lockdown is on and the spread is happening across Europe. We'll have updates each night. The first and only vice presidential debate is now in the books. And so's the fly. Today, Biden, Pence, Harris and all are on the campaign trail in the same state, Arizona. Then aside, how safe are the people who work the vote?
Go find a gun and kill yourself.
Working as an election administrator is not supposed to be dangerous.
By the end of the primary election, I was up to 9 death threats.
What everyday Americans are facing as we all prepare for the vote. Vaccine trials for adults in full swing. But how can we protect our children from COVID?
and dangerous power outages, trees down everywhere, the strong thunderstorms that clobbered the Northeast.
The facts, the truth, the news with Shepard Smith, back in 60 seconds.
To vote now, 26 days to go. Both campaigns are in Arizona today, where early voting is already happening. Dueling events, really. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris campaigning together for the first time, since the Democratic convention, meeting with Native American leaders and small business owners. And then there's Mike Pence and his wife filling in for President Trump, if you will, at a rally. According to a CNBC Change Research poll of likely voters, the former vice president is leading President Trump in Arizona by 6 points. Both campaigns have the state circled, really, as a must-win. President Trump got it by 3.5 points back in 2016, but now, in the polls at least, he's trailing. To Phoenix now, Vaughn Hilliard, live outside Biden-Harris event there. Hey, Vaughn.
Afternoon, Shep. You said it. Not only is Vice President Mike Pence just about 15 miles down the road from here, but Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are making local stops by bus here today. This is obviously a critical state, in a state that they're both focusing on, because back in 2016, Donald Trump won the state by just 3 percentage points, but now you see him consistently trailing. And this is a particularly critical time, because this is a state that has a deep history of early voting. Back in the 2018 midterms, 78% of voters here cast their vote by mail. And already thousands of Arizonans have gone to the polls to cast their votes here on this opening week of early voting. And millions of other ballots have made their way from Phoenix warehouse over to mailboxes. You know, this is a moment where suddenly Democrats are looking at this as a chance to change a longtime conservative state once held by the likes of Barry Goldwater, Jeff Flake, John McCain, and turn it blue.
Cindy McCain on the campaign trail today, right?
Cindy McCain is evidence of that. You know, this is a state that now Donald Trump won independents here just 4 years ago. Now, polling consistently shows him losing among independents anywhere from 20 to 25%. Cindy McCain is one of those longtime conservative voices here. And back after her husband's passing, just 2 months after he passed in 2018, she implored the Arizona Republican Party members to come together. But just 2 years later, it's her that is now standing with the Democratic nominees. And Joe Biden, we should note, the last time he came to Arizona before this visit was for John McCain's funeral back in 2018.
Chef? Vaughn Hilliard in Phoenix for us tonight. You know, on the list of top issues in this campaign, the Supreme Court seems to be way up there, doesn't it? You've seen the polls that a majority of voters would like the winner of November's election to fill the open seat. But what about the Democrats' talk of expanding the Supreme Court? It's been part of both debates.
Are you and Joe Biden, if somehow you win this election, going to pack the Supreme Court to get your way?
I'm so glad we went through a little history lesson. Let's do that a little more. In 1864...
Well, I'd like you to answer the question.
No, Mr. Yes. Vice President, I'm speaking.
Now,
are you pack the
make
court?
Sure you, in fact, let people know
he doesn't
you're
want
a senator. I'm not going to answer the question.
Why
because,
would you answer that because, question?
But it is a good question. But how does it play with voters? The answer really is in the data. NBC's Steve Kornacki has that. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Shep. Yes, some interesting numbers on this question here. Adding seats to the Supreme Court, should there be more than 9 on it? It was polled in the last week. This is a Washington Post poll here. And you can see, overall, wide opposition to that idea of adding seats to the Supreme Court. 56-31 opposed. Particularly wide opposition among independent voters. You see 61-29. So you put these two findings together, you could certainly understand the reluctance of a Biden or a Harris to come out there and publicly support it. But why won't they say they oppose it either? Because look at this. When you go deep inside the numbers in this poll, there's actually support among Democrats, plurality support among Democratic voters right now for expanding the Supreme Court. So if you're Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, you don't want to alienate your own side, but you're certainly aware of these numbers as well.
You know, there's a lot more data in there about the Supreme Court, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's a question here, too, just of this current nomination, the Amy Coney Barrett nomination. Should that be going through? You're asking voters right now. You know, we saw three polls come out in the last 24 hours on this. We said, what do we do when we get multiple polls? We average them. 46% of Americans, when you average them together, say they want the Coney Barrett nomination to go through now to be approved. And 46% say they oppose it and they want it rejected, dead even, 46-46.
Steve, we just heard from Vaughn Hilliard in Arizona. President Trump won that by 3.5. Now Joe Biden is up by 6 points. What do you see in there that's moving that? Do we know from the polling?
Yeah, in fact, I can call up Arizona, give you a sense of this. If you went back to 2016 in Arizona, you mentioned the 3.5-point margin, and it really is, it's this area right here. It's Maricopa County, it's the Phoenix metro area. This is, you know, 65% of the vote in the state's going to come out of here, and the gains that Democrats have made since 2016 around the country have been in places just like Phoenix. Big metropolitan areas, a lot of white-collar professionals, a lot of college degrees. Remember, Democrats won a Senate race in Arizona in 2018. It's why they won that Senate race. It's why Biden leads in those Arizona polls right now. It's why Democrats believe on election night, this giant red county here, they think they can flip it blue, and with it, Arizona.
Time will tell. Steve Kornacki, thanks.
You got it.
Struggling Americans will not be getting a stimulus check anytime soon. Relief talks between both sides of the aisle continue to stall. We have the latest out of Washington. And COVID spreading in the NFL so fast. Another player testing positive today. Another game postponed today. And there's breaking news from the NFL. But first, a violent attack on a Los Angeles police officer tops a CNBC trip coast to coast. California. A Los Angeles cop pistol whipped inside a police station. It was a bloody struggle. Officers say the suspect knocked the cop to the ground, grabbed his gun and hit him over the head with it, then ran out of the station and shot at a sergeant. The man took off, but cops caught him after a car chase. Massachusetts. Severe storms ripped through Milton last night. A transformer exploded. Trees snapped and fell right on cars and blocked roads. Thousands across the state still don't have electricity. Wisconsin. Protests.
Arrest the police!
After the Milwaukee DA said he would not prosecute a black police officer who shot and killed an armed black teenager back in February. Cops say protesters threw rocks into homes and at police. Officers used tear gas to break up the crowds. One homeowner confronted the protesters from his lawn.
You know how many Democrats, how many MPS teachers, union members, other people that could support you live on this street?
Support the cause, not the violence. Delaware. This was a family. A dad, mom, and occasionally a baby. Around the town of Lewis, they had a big following. Locals would dress them up for the Super Bowl, 4th of July, sometimes as healthcare workers to say thanks. But Route 9's pole family got wiped out this weekend. It was a hit and run, and all that's left is a mannequin's head. The town has now turned it into a memorial, remembering a favorite landmark. And that wraps this CNBC trip coast to coast. Another NFL player tested positive for COVID today on the Tennessee Titans team yet again. That's now 23 players and members of the organization all totaled. The league faces a scheduling crisis right about now. Sunday's Bills-Titan game may not happen. Tennessee was already forced to move their Week 4 game against the Steelers. There's no room left for another makeup, so they're not sure what to do. In a memo this week, the commissioner, Roger Goodell, told teams if they don't follow protocol, they may have to go as far as to make them forfeit games. And if that happens to the Titans, Buffalo gets the W, but not the money. Because under the new rules, both teams would have to give up their share of the cash for Week 5. And then there's this, brand new to us just now, the matchup between the Broncos and the Patriots is officially moved. It was scheduled for Sunday. Now they'll play it Monday. That's according to our NBC station in Denver. This comes after a Patriots player tested positive just yesterday. I'm loving it. Or at least Mayor McCheese is. McDonald's on top of CNBC's On the Money. Mickey D's struggled for much of the year as Americans ate at home most of the time, but they're pulling up to the second window now, let me tell you. Sales are up 5%. Sure, some of the dining rooms are still closed and getting the job done is tougher, like everything else is, but they still have fewer customers. Yet the ones they do have are spending more on average. That's what McDonald's says. Buy more burgers and fries and everything else per order. The dinner hour, now a bright spot for McDonald's, helped by strong sales of the new Travis Scott meal and spicy McNuggets. Then there's Dollar General. It's launching a new store. And this one will try to hook wealthier customers to the burbs. They're calling it Pop Shelf. It'll feature products for home and beauty, plus cleaning supplies and party goods. A dollar's still a dollar at the Dollar General store, but the company reports at the new one, Pop Shelf, most items will run $5 or less. And not your father's IBM, the century-old tech firm announcing it will be splitting up, spinning out its traditional technology business so it can focus on cloud computing. And then there's Amazon. It's unveiling a new electric delivery van. They released photos of the thing inside and out. So how many is Amazon buying? How many of these electric delivery vehicles? Only 100,000. And that's what's on the money. On Wall Street, the Dow up 122 on the session. The S&P about 1%. NASDAQ about 0.5%. I'm Shepard Smith on CNBC. It's the bottom of the hour. Time for the top of the news. Domestic terrorism. That's what the feds are calling a plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan and overthrow the government. Investigators say a group of men tied to militias also talked about attacking police and taking hostages at the Michigan State Capitol building. According to the feds, they were onto them from the beginning. They had plants inside the group. Yet all the while, they wanted to bring in explosives, including a homemade anti-personnel bomb with pennies packed for shrapnel. NBC's investigative reporter Tom Winter has been looking into these groups' suspected motives. Tom, you've learned there might be a link to the so-called Boogaloo movement?
That's right, Shepard. And it kind of sounds a little bit ridiculous to say, but in fact, this group is a very serious potential threat. They've already been linked to two deaths in California, one including a federal officer who was in charge of security outside of a courthouse, as well as another plot in the Las Vegas region. So this is not a group that is new to federal law enforcement. As you said, this was a operation where there were confidential human sources, as the FBI calls them. Commonly, we would refer to them as informants. On top of that, there were undercover FBI agents. And essentially, this group, it's kind of a little bit different than the typical militia ideology. The officials that you were referring to earlier, Shep, refer to this as a militia group. But really, it's a bit of a different ideology. They are very much anti-liberal groups or democratic groups. They're very much anti-law enforcement. There's indications here in the charging documents today that they were seeking addresses of police officers in that part of the country and that they wanted to kill them. And that's actually how one of the informants came to the attention of the FBI and agreed to begin working with them. So this is a group that has extreme ideologies. The Boogaloo phrase actually is an obscure movie reference from the early 1980s. And they're all over social media. They're all over Facebook. They're over Twitter, Reddit, various forums online, 4chan included. And it's really just a group that is absolutely on the fringe, but has really garnered a lot of attention in various online communities and obviously now has been involved in either plots that have come to fruition with people dying or in plots that were aspirational in nature, but obviously very serious. Certainly the idea of kidnapping the governor of Michigan, a very serious plot, Chuck.
Tom Winter, thank you. The sun sets on another day without disaster relief from Congress. Millions of Americans in need waiting for lawmakers to come up with money for families and small businesses. But because Washington, corporations first, the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says she will not support a standalone package for airlines unless and until she gets a guarantee for a bigger bill to help others. Another phone call with the Treasury Secretary Mnuchin. They've been doing that like daily. But another day of mixed messages. On the other side of the aisle, President Trump says he's all in for a new round of $1,200 stimulus checks. And an aide just said that the White House is going to go in with something even bigger. Of course, the day before, he shut down the whole discussion and declared no deal till after the election. But that was then, and this is now, as a good friend says. CNBC's Elon Moy is with us now. Is this talk, or might something be happening here? What do you know?
Well, Shep, it looks like we are right back to where we started before these talks were called off. Both sides still trying to figure out that magic number for a deal and what exactly should go into it. So far, Pelosi has not budged. Today, she shut down any speculation that the House might focus on helping only the airlines. She said she wouldn't move forward unless there was a deal that also addressed Democrats' other priorities, including money for state and local governments, schools, workplace safety, and unemployed workers. As for any kind of Republican skinny deal, Pelosi was also clear. Not going to happen.
This is deadly serious. So let's take a serious, not a skinny, not an emaciated, but a serious, appropriate approach to crushing the virus and then talk about some of the other good things that would flow from that.
But even in the Senate, where Republicans hold the majority, there was some turbulence over the idea of an airline-only aid package. Two prominent GOP senators, Pat Toomey and Mike Lee, they pointed out that this would leave behind the restaurants, the hotels, the movie theaters. They also came out against a taxpayer-funded handout for the airlines and instead called for a federal loan that eventually would have to be paid back. Now, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell admitted that he has got his hands full trying to keep Republicans all on the same page, and there are growing fears about how much this is going to cost.
Of course, I think we ought to act again. But when you've got a debt the size of your economy for the first time since World War II, it's not an argument for extravagant, unrelated spending.
Bottom line, Shep, Washington is still stuck in stalemate once again.
Elon, thank you. Washington's gridlock is crushing families and the job market. The numbers out this morning show almost 850,000 people filed for unemployment benefits just last week. And listen to this. The numbers have been this high or even higher every single week for the last 6 months. CNBC's chief economics correspondent Steve Leisman is here now. Give us some context on this, if you could, Steve.
Well, one way to think about it, Shep, is that in the worst week of the financial crisis, there were 665,000 new claims for jobless benefits. This week, as you said, 850,000. Every single of the 29 weeks since this crisis began has been above. Added all up, 32 million at the peak were receiving some type of jobless benefit. That number's come down to 25 billion. But the worst week in the financial crisis, the total Americans receiving benefits was 12 million. I worry, Shep, at this point, there's additional things happening underneath the economy that are cause for worry. Among them, that businesses that held on to this point, they no longer could hold on and are maybe shutting their doors, letting their workers go. I think the other part of this is some businesses that were doing okay, they have since been undermined by the ongoing weakness in the economy, even while the recovery has been faster than expected.
And people who don't have disaster money can't go out and spend that money. Therefore, the business doesn't have that money. I mean, it's a cycle. And you know what else is really disturbing, Steve? Women are dropping out of the workforce so much faster than men. How bad are those numbers?
It's so bad that they're calling this the she session, and mostly they've been called man sessions. But when you put it together, Shep, some 6 million women have either dropped out of the workforce or become unemployed. That's 800,000 more than men. That's a lot in its own right. But it's typical that men suffer worse during recessions because they have the economically sensitive jobs like construction and manufacturing. This time around, Shep, as you know, it's the service industries, the more stable service industries like restaurants and doctor's offices and airlines that have been hit the hardest. Typically, those are jobs where women tend to dominate, and they've been hit the hardest in this recession.
Steve Leisman, thank you. COVID vaccines for kids. Why parents may have to wait a while to get their kids immunized against the virus, no matter what happens. And putting the pedal to the metal for a soft drink. How they're stopping the spread of germs in Japan.
The facts, the truth, the news with Shepard Smith. Back in 90 seconds.
Worried about your kids bringing it home? Kids in New Jersey are catching COVID at school. That's what the governor said today. Governor Phil Murphy out with new numbers. 16 outbreaks linked to in-school transmission, talking all ages, K through 12. So far, 58 cases confirmed. Jersey health officials say they're working with educators to try to stop the spread. So how do we protect the kids from COVID? Well, there are dozens of vaccines in trials right now, but they're only for adults. CNBC's Meg Terrell on why making a vaccine for your children is tricky.
Parents will be waiting longer for a COVID-19 vaccine for their kids than most think.
One of the worst things right now is just the fear of the unknown. So once we take away that, I think that it could be good for everybody.
A public school teacher of 17 years, Kara Doyle, had just put away her number two pencils to start a new business when COVID-19 hit the U.S. With the uncertainty of the pandemic, she decided to keep her kids home from school and teach them herself. Doyle is hopeful a vaccine will help with a return to normalcy. But experts like Emory's Dr. Evan Anderson point out vaccines in development for COVID-19 aren't yet being tested in children.
The downside to that, it will delay the timeline for identifying the safety and immune response and the correct dose needed in children, which might well vary from adults.
Drug companies developing vaccines say they're waiting on more data in adults before starting pediatric trials. Moderna, among frontrunners, said it plans to start trials in children by the end of this year. Pediatricians say it's crucial children are included in the trials, with the American Academy of Pediatrics writing a letter to Health Secretary Alex Azar and FDA Commissioner Stephen Hahn. It notes children can and do spread the virus, with more than 587,000 infections in kids in the U.S. alone, about 10% of all cases. More than 100 children have died from the virus, with more than two-thirds being Black and Latinx.
There's actual deaths in children that are happening at a rate for which is now similar to that for influenza.
Dr. Anderson says there's enough data in adults now to support starting pediatric trials. And he warns the window for including children in the trials in time to have a vaccine for back to school next year is closing. For now, Kara Doyle is staying positive.
We're hopeful that it will be something that can help everyone, not just our family, but everybody.
CNBC's Meg Terrell. A massive drug bust in Barcelona and protests in Southeast Asia as we go around the world in 80 seconds. Indonesia. Protests turning violent. Thousands of students and workers say they're mad about the country's new labor law. Demonstrators burning down the police station near Jakarta's presidential palace. Riot police firing tear gas at the angry mob. Indonesia's parliament passed legislation aimed at attracting more investment to the country. Protesters say the law will cripple labor rights and hurt the environment. Spain. Police arresting more than 50 people in a massive drug bust in Barcelona. National and local police cracking down on narco flats, apartments in poor neighborhoods where users get their heroin and cocaine fixes. The operation involved more than 1,000 agents and more than 40 searches around the city. Finland. Meet 16-year-old Ava. She became the prime minister of Finland for a day. She got to meet the ministers and members of parliament. This is all part of a UN initiative letting girls from around the world take over different leadership roles. What were you doing at 16? Japan. Playing footsie with a machine. A Japanese company rolling out a vending machine that can be used with your feet. You choose your drink by stepping on the pedal, then you pay with your phone. It's expected to cut down on the spread of coronavirus, a step in the right direction as we go around the world in 80 seconds. Hurricane warning. Delta expected to hit South Louisiana tomorrow. The state still recovering from two storms ago. Hurricane Laura was a monster. Tonight, what one hurricane expert fears the most as Delta batters the bio. Plus, on-the-job hazards, death threats, and envelopes stuffed with COVID spit. Tonight, election workers and all their troubles. A monster storm's getting stronger and headed right for Louisiana. Look how close it is already. That's the Texas coast, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama. See that? It's Hurricane Delta. Upgraded as it churns through the Gulf. It's a Cat 3 now. Life-threatening, as they put it. That's according to the National Hurricane Center. Landfall is expected tomorrow night at some point, but the rain's almost there. The projected winds then, 110 miles an hour. Storm surge up to 11 feet in places like Vermilion Bay. It's expected to roar across the state while lashing Mississippi before heading north. Tennessee expected to get it too. And already, more than 90% of oil production in the Gulf shuttered. Live to the National Hurricane Center now, meteorologist Ken Graham is the director. Ken, some storms, it's the wind, others, it's the water. What does Delta worry you?
I'll tell you what, Delta, you start looking at the size of this storm. I mean, you're looking at hurricane-force winds, which is definitely going to be dangerous. But the other part of it is, besides those hurricane-force winds, Shep, it's the size of this storm, a large expanse of those tropical storm-force winds. Listen, 140 to 160 miles out from the center, so a large area could see that. And the larger the storm, Shep, the more the storm surge. That's the deadliest part of these hurricanes.
This thing has the center of the cone of uncertainties moved just a little bit left, and that looks like Lake Charles is about to get hit again.
Yeah, you think about it, you know, going back to an area that got hit by Hurricane Laura and then another one here with the winds and the storm surge. I mean, you look at some of these values. I was listening to what you were saying with that 11 foot. I mean, just right along that center and to the right-hand side. I mean, some of these areas, 5 to 8 foot, Holly Beach to the Rockefeller Wildlife Refuge, but over Vermilion Bay to Morgan City, 7 to 11 foot of storm surge, not just on the coast, but every one of those bayous that normally drains all that rain out. It's going to flow backward, and it's going to push that storm surge in.
When it came past the Yucatan, it was churning along, moving forward at about 17 miles an hour, so it wouldn't sit for very long. What about now? What's the forward speed?
Yeah, forward speed, the latest we have, 12 miles an hour. And even if it makes that bend as it turns, we still expect it to be moving. We don't see any reason this will stall out like some storms in the past. This will keep on moving. And even though it's moving quickly, that could bring some of those hurricane force winds further inland. So it takes time to bring those winds down. So even inland, we have a hurricane even early Saturday morning around Alexandria, Louisiana. So power outages, trees down, it's a big impact.
So up in Natchez and Jackson and up into even the central part of Tennessee?
Yeah, you can see some of these winds. I mean, the tropical storm, even getting towards the Mississippi Delta, and that's Saturday afternoon. So, yeah, you think about that and the rainfall. So it's not just the storm surge. You really have to look at the rainfall as well, and that could be significant with some of these 6 to 10 inches of rain in some areas associated with this rain. So, but look at this wind field. I mean, you look at the tropical storm force winds. We're talking about the size of the storm. There's places, southeast Louisiana, all the way to the upper Texas coast, could see some of these winds. So it's just a large storm, and that means more people are going to see that wind. They're going to see that rainfall and the storm surge.
Here we go again. Ken Graham, coverage here, same time tomorrow. The vote now, the presidential debate, the next one will be, well, that's TBD. It's supposed to be a town hall style thing a week from today in Miami, but the president has coronavirus, so the Commission on Presidential Debate switched it to viral. Just a few minutes later, the president said on TV, I won't do it, not virtual. Then the Biden camp suggested October 22nd, and the president said, sure, as long as it's in person and as long as there's a third and final debate set for October the 29th, just a few days before the election, and Joe Biden said no. So we'll see. Like everything 2020, uncertainty reigns. Tough jobs now, right? Debate moderators won. And in 2020, election administrator. Yeah, the people who make sure your votes get counted, some of them say people are really coming for them. Hate calls, even death threats. And some of it is disturbing, like what you're about to see because it's recorded. Here's CNBC's Andrea Day.
If you pull some crap and unregister me to vote, I will hunt you down. You have no right! No right!
By the end of the primary election, I was up to 9 death threats.
Whoever's in charge of this should be hung from a tree.
He's Kentucky Board of Elections Executive Director Jared Deering. And these are just some of the voicemails he's getting at the office.
Go find a gun and kill yourself.
It's incredibly disturbing.
Same scene in Nevada, where Deanna Spicula is running 2 of the swing state's elections offices.
They are cursing at our staff. They're using very threatening words.
And hitting workers across the country just trying to do their job.
Damn you! I will destroy you in a court of law.
I just hope and pray every night that you get mangled up in a horrible car wreck and you die slowly over hours.
We've always seen some level of anger from the electorate.
But this year, it's getting extreme.
This is upsetting. This is disgusting.
And adding fuel to the fire, a commander-in-chief who's throwing doubt on the process.
This is going to be a fraud like you've never seen.
Presidential years are always a little more heightened as far as tensions out there, but this one has been just over the top as far as anything I have ever seen.
She's talking about things like this. It came to her office in the mail, a weaponized ballot that reads here at the top, sealed with COVID-19 spit.
I couldn't even fathom a reason why somebody would do something like that.
It doesn't really have a party line that it's focusing on. I think everyone's on edge right now.
It might just be one of the worst jobs in America at this point. So throw in the towel? Not happening for these two.
It does get to you, but this is the career I chose.
And this is going to sound like a ridiculous statement, but you know, there are 50 states, six territories, and there are 56 elections directors across the country. You know, I have one of the 56 best jobs in the country.
For the news, I'm Andrea Day.
Andrea, we did some digging on that envelope supposedly sealed with COVID spit. Washoe County Sheriff says this is the guy who sent it. Donald Wasson is his name, arrested in Reno, charged with a felony called dispensing hoax. Not hard to track him because the ID on the ballot linked right back to his real name and his real address. The cops say he signed this confession, quoting now, "I am sorry I was so damn stupid." The penalty upon conviction, up to 4 years in the Hooskow, but Watson got lucky. They couldn't prove it was his own COVID spit, so the Reno DA dropped the charges. You go to a bar, you got to wear a mask. That's the rule in some places where they still have that whole bar thing. But as one waitress in Pennsylvania learned, not everybody's down. When you go to a restaurant or a local business these days, you wear a mask. That's how it goes most places. It's the law for some, the rule for others, but you post to because science and polite. Of course, some people hate. But stiff the waitress? It is not her fault.
Can you please put your mask on if you're walking through the bar? They were kind of like they brushed it off their shoulder and they said, well, you know, it's no big deal. We're going to sit down anyway.
As you can imagine, it's happened before, but what happened next had never happened. Instead of leaving a tip, the customer wrote in mask.
It's not about the $5 tip that would have been 20%. It's about the disrespect. It's about us working hard, and it's just like a slap in the face.
I couldn't even tell you how much I don't care about the money. I just, you know, right now, it's hard for us. I don't want to tell you what to do. I really don't want to tell any other adult what to do, but, you know, I do have to abide by her rules.
This picture of the receipt quickly spread through social media, and since then, there's been an outpouring of appreciation.
I had someone Venmo request me so that they could Venmo me a tip for her.
Somebody slipped money in this card underneath the door, which was awesome. Their kids signed the card.
She's not mad and certainly holds no grudge. In fact, Jamie is taking the high road past it all.
Sometimes people have bad days, so maybe he had a bad day. The biggest point of all is just be kind to everybody that you come across.
60 seconds left on a race to the finish. The FBI busting a plot to kidnap the governor of Michigan. Investigators say a group of men tied to militias secretly trained together, built some bombs, scouted the governor's vacation home, and ultimately planned to overthrow the government. Thankfully, the feds found out early, were watching all along, and arrested the bunch. But Michigan's attorney general has a warning. She says she thinks these guys might be just the beginning. COVID on the rise in the United States. 41 states reporting an increase in cases. 23 states seeing hospitalizations up. And Hurricane Delta getting bigger and stronger, and Louisiana could be in for a world of hurt all over again. Delta now a Cat 3, expected to make landfall tomorrow night. And now, you know the news for this Thursday, October the 8th. I'm Shepard Smith. Have a great one. We'll see you right back here, same time tomorrow. You've been listening to the CNBC podcast, The News with Shepard Smith. You can always catch us live weekdays at 7 p.m. Eastern, only on CNBC.